And welcome to Hour 2 of the Daily Circuit. I'm Kate Smith. We continue our education focus now with a look at a school system many people don't know about. Across the country, there are nearly 50,000 children attending classes at schools run by the federal government. About 180 schools under the Bureau of Indian Education teach American Indian students. A third of these schools get a poor rating in a report out this year. The buildings are in such need of repair and renovation, it would cost more than $1 billion to bring them all up to par. One school on that list is in Minnesota, the Buganagashik School on the Leech Lake Indian Reservation. Earlier this year, a couple of key visits raised some people's hopes. President Obama visited the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North Dakota, and just a couple of months ago, his Interior Secretary came to Minnesota to visit what many people fondly refer to as the Bug School. This morning, a chance to learn more about what's needed, about how school conditions affect student learning, and about whether there's been any word since those high-profile visits. We have several guests. Crystal Redgrave joins us by phone. She's superintendent of the Bug School in Bena. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Dennis Olson is here in the studio with us. He's director of American Indian Education for the Minnesota Department of Education. Dennis, good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
And Jill Burkham joins us. She sort of got this conversation started when a few of us here read her series of stories in the Star Tribune. She's a reporter and writes opinion stories, and she highlighted Minnesota and South Dakota's Indian schools and the impoverished state of that federal school system. Thanks for joining us, Jill.
Thank you for having me.
Crystal Redgrave, you've testified before a congressional committee, to my count now, 3 years in a row?
The school has done a testimony,
right.
But last March I did go to the Washington, D.C., and did do a testimony.
And I wonder if you would share with us what the main point you make for the 200 students in your school. What is it that you cannot provide to your students at the Bug School?
The main point is a safe facility. And here at Buganagashik School, we have basically a pole barn facility for our high school students. And the bottom line is it's unsafe and it's not fit for students to learn in, and it's just really not just or fair. So that was my message.
Are there academic things that you also can't provide to some of your high school students?
Yes, there is. At the high school, we do not have a facility equipped for a science lab. The school was again a pole barn facility, and it was a transportation garage. It was intended for that, and the science room is actually where the buses were supposed to be garaged. So we don't have the infrastructure for a science laboratory.
And what about, I'm just thinking, a place where buses were supposed to be, probably there are some safety issues involved in that building?
There's a plethora of safety issues. With the bus barn structure, there's, poor insulation, poor ventilation. Even the doors and the security is an issue. The floors are uneven. We've had to add extensions to the facility so we can accommodate our students and classrooms. So there's been much maintenance. So we have flooding. We have roof. The part of the roof actually caved in a couple of times. We have heat problems. We just have a lot of issues.
Dennis Olson, your job, as I understand it, is to work with the state's tribes to provide education.
Correct.
For Indian students. And there are a number of school systems that Indian students can take advantage of. There are tribally run schools. There are K-12 public schools. There are the federally run schools that we're talking specifically about this morning. How do students and their families make choices about which of these systems to take advantage of?
So in Minnesota, we have a little over 20,000 American Indian students in our K-12 system. And that includes the schools that Superintendent Redgrave is talking about, the Bureau of Indian Education-funded schools. In Minnesota, we have 4 Bureau of Indian Education-funded schools, one on the Fond du Lac Reservation, one on the Leech Lake Reservation, the Bug School, one on the Mille Lacs Reservation, Neosing Schools, and one in White Earth, that'd be in the Circle of Life Academy. And those schools enroll about 800 American Indian students. And so if you do the math, That's about 4% of our American Indian students that are attending BIE schools here in the state. That means that 96% of our American Indian students attend public school here in Minnesota. And so, although this is a really important issue to us and we care deeply about the BIE system and the facilities issues that are going on, particularly at the Bug School, we also don't want to take attention away from all of our American Indian students in the state that also need attention mm-hmm. when we're talking about these issues.
Jill Burkham, your reporting took you to some of these federally run schools, both here in Minnesota and in South Dakota. And because your stories, I think I get this right, appear on the opinion page, they have a different kind of perspective, point of view. And you use some pointed language in a couple of places in your stories. I want to just read a quote here. You write, "Federal officials may be fine with the Bug School conditions for now, but Minnesotans shouldn't be. Children in a state that's long relied on an educated workforce as its leading economic asset should not be getting their education in a school that is an unsafe impediment to learning." And you continue, "Action is needed now. Governor Dayton should appoint a task force to kickstart the effort." What kind of response did you get to that kind of writing?
Again, I'm an editorial writer, so yes, I do have a point of view when I write. And, you know, I think the reason for the pointed language was the frustration that I felt as a mom when I walked into facilities on the Bug and Nigishig campus and also out in South Dakota. These are Minnesota kids. These are South Dakota kids. They deserve the same type of chance to succeed in life that that kids all over the state have. So in terms of the reaction, I think generally it's been positive. We've heard from state legislators who are as outraged as I am, who live up in that neck of the woods and are planning to introduce legislation to try to secure funding for the Bug and Nigishig School. On the federal level, I really applaud Interior Secretary Sally Jewell for the response that she has had to this series. Speaking at a White House tribal conference, Tribal Nations Conference earlier this month, she said that it was painful to read that type of language, which was one of the reasons that I used it. I wanted it to have an impact. I wanted it to stay with people. But she also said that it was helpful. And I believe that you know, the message to her and to other federal officials such as Arnie Duncan, the Secretary of Education, who also needs to become an advocate for these schools, is that, you know, this is possible. Someone is watching. In our case, out in Minnesota, we're out here in the tundra, but we're big enough to make a difference. And we're outraged by the status of schools in Minnesota and South Dakota. And I hope that it encourages them to get over kind of this defeatist attitude that they've had about funding these schools and to seek out the kind of funding that they need and to develop the type of plan that the military schools have. And they are, you know, doing this massive makeover of their schools.
Federally run military
schools. Right. This is the other federal K through 12 system. Mm-hmm. They have set out a mission. They're on a mission to have the schools of the future. That's the type of response I want to see from Congress and Jewell and Duncan.
Your reports also indicated a question about possibly other streams of funding for these federally run Indian schools. Crystal Redgrave, I wonder about what you think about that. Should there be state money coming to your school? Should there be tribal money coming to your school?
Well, you know, the BIE does have an obligation to Native American children and communities. I think the entire United States has an obligation to Native Americans. You know, the past, you know, who we are today really is, has, you know, a deep impact of history. And we, you know, as Native Americans have, we have survived and we continue to exist. And so, you know, there is an obligation for all people and, you know, part of the United States. The Leech Lake Nation has taken a priority on education and they do fund the Bug and Nigishig School. We do receive local funding from them. So, you know, it's a shared responsibility, I believe, and but I really strongly do believe that the Congress, through appropriations, I think that's where justice comes. If they recognize and acknowledge their responsibilities to Native American children and the communities and for our past and history, then, they would provide a safe facility for all Native children. You know, especially at the Bureau-run and Bureau of Tribal Schools.
Crystal, tell us, just give us an example of something that you're doing that has nothing to do with money, that is a good example for us of what people call culturally cored curriculum.
Okay. Here at Bugganagijik, you know, this school, I've served at many different types of schools across the United States. My husband and I, we travel to different areas. He works for IHS, so it's kind of like the military. We get uprooted often. But I have, you know, had an opportunity to serve in different capacities, from a teacher to a director of curriculum, principal to a superintendent, also as a consultant and also for the state. But in my experiences, you know, the Bugganagijik School truly does teach culture and language. They teach it from a very, almost a peer core, sticking to their traditions and knowing who they are. So here at the Bugganagijik School, we do all the, according to the moon, the activities like seasonal ricing and maple syruping. We also do tanning hides. I believe right now they're getting ready to go ice fishing, and they both incorporate the historical ways of doing things, but also with the new technologies. And so we really equip the students with a strong base of place and identity and how they belong. And that's not, you know, it's rare. That's what I see as a Native American educator in other schools.
Dennis Olson, I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot here. I wonder what you think about the kind of raw political power the Interior Department has to advocate for schools. This is a department that's about parks, and yet because of the federal bureaucracy, these tribal schools, these Indian schools run by the federal government, come under the purview of the Interior Department.
Right. And, you know, I think it's paramount that we remember that this is a failure of the federal government to uphold its trust responsibility to Indian schools. And this, you know, is not a failure of the state in any regard. And I'm not sure if the Interior Department is being creative enough in making the correct ask. And I think that's been highlighted by the series of stories. This is a trust responsibility that the federal government has, not only to the BIE system, but also, as highlighted in the articles, the Department of Defense. And there's a clear equity issue going on between the two.
And I want to just drill down one more layer on that. You and Crystal Redgrave have both said trust responsibility. What does that mean?
So without getting too deep into the weeds and talking about federal Indian policy, essentially the trust responsibility is the federal government's responsibility through treaties to educate American Indian students. Out of the 391 treaties that were ratified during the treaty-making period from the United States between tribes, over 150 of them have specific educational provisions and responsibilities that the federal government must provide to Indian students in perpetuity.
Do you think these schools would be better placed with state supervision?
You know, we're looking at all options, but as Jill had mentioned earlier, the federal government is really looking at working closely with tribes, particularly under the Obama administration, to transition responsibility to tribes and have tribes take more ownership of their own schools, and that be fiscally, that be governance. And tribes, you know, many tribes are positioned to do just that. And it's in the best interest of the federal government, I think, as Crystal had mentioned, to develop more of a shared responsibility. A lot of tribes have already stepped up because of the failure of the government around facilities funding in particular. Tribes have stepped up financially because they've had to, because they care about their kids. And so they've had to put money there where the federal government should have been funding these opportunities.
Crystal Redgrave, have you a good sense that if the Bug School came under the purview of the Leech Lake Band, that it could run the school well?
Running a school is very complex. I mean, there's many, many aspects to running an organization. But, you know, with the, I think it was 1988, it was with the establishment of the Tribal Education Department, and that was the hope, is that the tribes would take over control and of their schools, and they would be able to self-determine through education. And, you know, it's a learning process, and nothing can be built overnight, but I do believe that's a long-term goal for myself as a Native American educator is to assist tribal entities to really develop those systems so that we can, you know, develop our own cultural standards and academic standards. We can base it upon our way of, our way of thinking, our way of knowledge, our way of understanding. After really, you know, my background is curriculum, but after really analyzing the standards in various states, I really, you know, see it's really entrenched with Western ideologies. And, you know, as a Native American growing up, you know, on a reservation and, you know, culturally, there is a significant difference. And having the state take over tribal schools, they just may, you know, push forward with the linear thinking, and that would basically take away who we are as Native Americans. And so I do, you know, strongly believe that tribes to develop their tribal education departments and create their assessments and certifications and standards.
Dennis Olson, your former life was as Education Commissioner for Mille Lacs, the
Correct.
Mille Lacs Band?
That's correct.
And what is Mille Lacs's involvement in the school?
The Neosheng
school. Neosheng?
Correct. Yeah, the Mille Lacs Band has a well-established tribal education department that works in concert with the administration at the Neosheng schools, and actually the school system falls under the governance structure of the Tribal Education Department of the Mille Lacs Band.
A model?
It is a great model, absolutely. And, you know, the Tribal Education Department wears a lot of different hats, looks at the both tribal and state-funded Head Start programs, child care, the K-12 Neosheng schools, the higher education programs, tribal scholarships, tribal college. So certainly that fits very well if you look at a complete pipeline that's under tribal control.
Is there any similar relationship between the Cloquet School with Fond du Lac and the Circle of Life with White Earth?
There are relationships. Yeah, the Fond du Lac Ojibwe school system works really closely with the Fond du Lac Band as well. And you got to remember our BIE schools in Minnesota, they're all tribal contract schools. And so they are under the control of the local tribal community and of the tribal nation.
Jill Burkham, as you were reporting your series of stories on these federally run Indian schools, I'm really curious what you came away with in terms of where the tipping points are. Is this truly all about money? Is this truly about political power and who wants what for whom? How did you sense that as you did your reporting?
That's a very good question. You know, it is an equity issue, as Dennis pointed out earlier. You know, the Department of Defense has a lot of powerful allies in Congress, and they made a push to modernize their school system, you know, as we were 10 years into a war, and there had been some bad press about the conditions at Walter Reed Hospital. And so they decided we aren't going to raise that concern about our school systems, and we're just going to go get the money. And they did so in the teeth of a recession, and they managed to pull it off. You know, this launched in 2011. It was approved in 2010. I just don't see the same urgency or sense of mission on the Department of Interior side. You know, this is a very small agency. I think that there's kind of a defeatist attitude about seeking out the funding that they need. I don't think that they have the same powerful allies in Congress as the Department of Defense does. So, yes, it's about politics. It's about equity. It's about money. And I also think that there's kind of a sense that maybe, you know, these kids aren't as deserving, perhaps, as other kids for whatever reason. And that's a sense that you also pick up out on the reservations when you talk to people.
Crystal Redgrave, as I recall, you and some of the kids from the Bug School were out in Washington with the Capitol Christmas tree not too long ago.
I didn't attend, but yeah, we sent 36 students, actually I think 38 students, to Washington, D.C.
Wonderful. I'm wondering if there was any communication from Washington back your way since some of these high-profile visits, other than to thank you for the Christmas tree.
They usually, you know, get in contact with the tribal chairwoman or the tribal executive team over in Leech Lake. But, you know, anecdotally, things are positive. You know, at least we were on the discussion and, you know, and people, we have support. I do know that across various levels, locally, the statewide, even nationally, we get letters. The school does, just from independent, you know, people. And then also, we do have the delegation from the state. They all support Baganagijic. So we have a lot of support here, and it all sounds pretty positive. But you know, I don't know if money is in the future for a school.
Are you concerned at all if the money isn't forthcoming soon that you'll start losing students?
Well, our attendance, our enrollment, you know, it's always declining once the students get into high school. And that's just something that we have to project. But, you know, I believe the students really come here because of the culture and the language and the sense of family and community here. And so, you know, it's a choice that they have to determine once they get into the high school. But, you know, I really believe that we're always going to have a K-12 program here. I think there's always going to be a pocket of families that choose to send their kids to Baganagijic.
It's been wonderful talking with you this morning. I really appreciate your time, Crystal Redgrave.
Thank you.
She's joined us from Bena, where she's superintendent of the Baganagijic School. And Dennis Olson, thanks for your time, too.
Thanks for having me.
He's American Indian Education Director for the Minnesota Department of Education. And Jill Burkham, for getting us going on this conversation. I really appreciate your series in the Star Tribune.
Thank you.
We've been talking this hour about federal schools for American Indian students. And if you want to know more about it, go to the Star Tribune website. We don't say that very often. And check out Jill Burkham's series of stories on those schools, including the Baganagijic School in northern Minnesota.